Good evening, everyone. As Michael said, my name is Laura McQuaid. I'm president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. And for those of you who don't know who Planned Parenthood is, I'll just kind of narrow it down for you here in New York City. So we provide health services through health centers in all five boroughs. We serve 100,000 patients a year in those five centers, and we provide the full range of sexual and reproductive health care, from annual exams, including breast and cancer screenings, to birth control counseling, STD testing, and, of course, access to in-clinic and medication abortion services. And we call our model the three legs of the stool. And the provision of health care is the first leg of that stool. In addition, here in New York City, we educate over 25,000 young people and adults every year on human sexuality, safe sexuality, and really to enable people to embrace their own sexuality and live the healthy lives that they want to live. And the third piece, of course, is the policy and advocacy work that we engage in. So when we were asked to be part of this incredible event, we couldn't have been more enthusiastic to co-host. We are just thrilled that the awareness of menstrual equity globally and specifically here in the U.S., led very much by Jen's fantastic work and the work that's happening here in New York City, is gaining such traction. Why does it matter? What is menstrual equity? Why does it matter? You may not know this, but in parts of the world, well, if you read Jen's book, you do, but in parts of the world, girls can't go to school. It's not because they don't want to go to school. They're forbidden by law from going to school. And here in New York City, because of lack of access to menstrual products, girls may not be able to participate in sports. They may not be able to go to school and really live the fullest aspects of the lives that they want. We see menstrual equity as a key and growing element of the sexual health and rights movement here in the U.S. and globally. And that's why we're so proud to stand up here today at this event. We were proud to work with Jen Weiss-Wolf and Councilmember Jalissa Ferraris-Copeland on the bill that was passed last year in New York City that ensured that menstrual products are freely available in all of the city's middle and high schools, shelters, and correctional facilities. It's a huge deal. And Representative Ming may not make it here, but she's been leading this fight on the national level, and we're proud to support legislation to make menstrual products more affordable and accessible across the country. This is a real problem. This isn't a made-up problem. This is a real problem that girls and women have been experiencing for generations. And lack of access to menstrual products causes inequity that's detrimental to those who are most marginalized. Much like many other aspects of the sexual and reproductive health and rights movement, anytime bad laws are passed or a problem goes undetected, the most marginalized of us experience these problems in hyper-focus. This, of course, as you know, goes to the heart of what we do every day at Planned Parenthood and with our partner organizations across the city. PPMYC operates with the belief that we have a responsibility to address these inequities. We don't just call them out, but we partner with those who call them out to make sure that access to change is real in people's lives. And we must understand that these inequities are rooted in gender, race, class, sexual orientation, gender identity, economic, and neighborhood status. They drive the healthcare disparities that we see every single solitary day here in the city and across the country. Access to menstrual products is one of these key issues, and our society and our lawmakers have been too long silent for fear of talking about female bodies, what might be perceived as female sexuality. To have these issues brought into the light in such an incredible way is so important and so needed. We're excited to co-host tonight's discussion with Jen Weiss-Wolf and with Abigail Jones of Newsweek. And we thank you for coming out tonight. And with that, I will turn it over to the stars of the evening.
it on? Yeah.
I think it's on.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for being here tonight. I'm really thrilled and honored to get to share the stage with Jennifer Weiss-Wolf. We met on the phone for the first time about a year and a half ago, and since then, I think we have spent hours and hours and hours talking on the phone about periods and menstrual products and policy and politics and so many other issues relating to these. And when I was sitting down to think about how to kick off this conversation, I actually went back to my notes from my very first interview that I ever had with her. And I was curious, what was the first thing Jen ever said to me? And and this is it. She said, "We have an obligation to ensure that women are not held back just because they can't afford or access tampons, pads, or menstrual products. If someone is unproductive at work or can't pay attention in school, that's bad for all of us. But the tampon tax is just the tip of the iceberg." And I thought those were really fitting words because that's what we're here to talk about tonight, the rest of that enormous iceberg and the work that Jen has been doing to chip away at it to affect real, meaningful change to people all around the world. So over the last couple of years, periods have really become a potent political issue, and as Jen's book title suggests, they have definitely gone public. One aspect of that is this cover story that I wrote for Newsweek a year and a half ago with this enormous white tampon on the front. It sparked a lot of conversation on social media, in certain groups of people. Certainly in the office, there were a few of us, all women, who worked on putting this out, and we loved talking very loudly about the design and the headlines, and we yelled tampons a lot at work.
You too.
And since then, I see menstrual equity everywhere. It's in new laws that focus on access to products passed at all levels of government. It's in colleges and universities, including here at NYU, that are making menstrual products freely available. And there's a steady series of periods in the headlines almost every single day. The issue is especially timely right now in our current political environment. Menstruation gets to the heart of the way we talk about and elevate women's experiences. So I'm so thrilled to be here with you, Jen. Your advocacy and your new amazing book is catapulting this conversation around periods and policy. And, you know, we're disappointed that Congresswoman Meng can't be here with us this evening. She's been the leading lawmaker taking on menstrual equity, access, and safety. But we're so fortunate to have her senior policy advisor here, Rachna Shah, in the front row. And she's going to offer, she'll answer a couple questions during the program. So, Jen, yes, let's go. As a journalist, I always like to start in the beginning to lay the foundation. So I know you wrote this whole book and you've been working on this issue for a while. What made you take on periods? What was it that made that light bulb go off and you realized that menstruation, which has been so ignored for basically forever, could actually be at the heart of a major policy issue?
All right, here we go. It's funny because hearing everyone talk about this and talking about it so much myself lately, it feels like something I've always done and always known. But the truth is, this is really new to me, especially. It's been a little over two and a half years. It's the most kind of basic organic story, which maybe shouldn't even be surprising given the topic. But it was a very sort of simple life moment that was the hugest click that I think I've ever experienced. So if you've read the book or seen the introduction, it basically goes back to New Year's Day 2015. And I was on social media that day. It was kind of a good New Year's Day. I had a lot of adrenaline. I do the Coney Island polar bear swim. And so I'd gotten a good jolt to my system that morning. Yeah, you'll read all about it in the intro. There's even more to it than that. But we'll start with just, I had a lot of sand, a lot of glitter, a lot of energy. And I was on Facebook posting some photos of the fun. And I scrolled into my news feed, and there was just this flyer or post from two teenage kids in my community who were doing a collection drive of tampons and pads for our local food pantry. And that was it. It was as simple as that. I saw it. I kind of never think it was really an accident in the scheme of life that I saw it on New Year's Day, because I did have all that adrenaline. And if it was like a mucky March day, I might have just seen it and moved on. But I saw it, and it really just made me stop in my tracks. And I couldn't believe, actually, that this was something I had never thought of before. It made perfect sense. Periods can be hard for the best of us to manage on a good day, let alone somebody who is marginalized or lacks agency in any way. I think anyone in the room who's ever had a period could tell you how bad it feels to be in a moment where you can't, you know, manage what's going on at that moment. And, oh my God, what am I going to do? How am I going to get through the next 5 minutes? How am I going to get through the next 15 minutes? The thought of somebody not being able to get through 5 days of that month after month, it really just kind of shook me to my core. I started Googling, basically, and trying to figure out what this was. Why did these kids know something I didn't know? What was there to know? And there are three things I actually came up with pretty quickly that day. One is that in many parts of the world, especially in the Global South and in Africa, this, and it was mentioned by our friends at Planned Parenthood, this actually is been deemed a human rights issue and public health crisis by the United Nations and the World Health Organization. The idea that this intersection of poverty and religious and cultural stigma and all sort of the trappings that come with that really do marginalize young girls in their ability to attend school, women's ability to be productive or attend work. And there's also incredible innovation that was happening around it. And that, too, was really remarkable to see. I was sort of floored, even upon reading it then, that I'd never really heard of it, that it wasn't headline-worthy, because, quite frankly, it's some groundbreaking, innovative, entrepreneurial, exciting things that are happening from local drives to create products out of naturally found ingredients, to women's entrepreneurial engagement with their communities, ability to create pads, make money, sell them, educate those around them. I didn't even know at the time or appreciate at the time that within the next 2 years I was going to get to travel to India and to Nepal and to Kenya and to see these ideas in action. But anyway, that was among the first things that I learned. The second was, I found this essay, and it was written by the feminist writer Jessica Valente. And it was called The Case for Free Tampons, and it was published in The Guardian in August 2014. And she made a lot of the arguments and put forth a lot of the ideas that are happening, that we're seeing, you know, getting legislative traction now. But at the time when she wrote it, it was like this hideous right-wing Breitbart fest just kind of, you know, submerged her. And it was just disgusting and awful. And it was the true idea that really stood out to me was this intersection of misogyny and poverty, how much people in this country hate poor women. And the idea that they just wanted everything for free. None of it even makes sense when you put it together. You want your birth control for free. You want your abortions for free. You want your babies for free. You want your tampons for free. That was really the tone of it. And then the third kind of discovery that day was that there was nothing otherwise being said about it in this country, in our media, in our national discourse, about whether, if, or how this was a problem, and whether we should even wonder if it could be. I would find every so often sort of a local shelter or food pantry would have a call for these products in their list of things, but that was about it. So with all these thoughts kind of churning through my head, I wasn't really sure what to do with them at the time. I'm going to answer sort of the second part of your question about the policy agenda, but that came a little later, so I just sort of want to get us through the day that lasted forever, in my mind. So anyway, I I put all these ideas on paper. It was the best way I could think of to process them. And I turned it into this essay. And because, again, all that New Year's resolution adrenaline within me, I thought, well, who's the most important person who might see this and care as much as I do and want to help elevate this story? And there could have been a lot of people. Somehow I decided it was New York Times columnist Nick Kristof, who I didn't know or have any particular reason to think he would read this and react in any way. But I sent it to him, and he did react. He wrote back and said he'd like to publish the piece. So that was an exciting moment and an opportunity to actually do what was brewing in my head right now, which was elevate this story and hope everybody would have the same reaction to it that I did upon hearing it. But remember, as was pointed out, and as you all know from being here at NYU, I work for the Brennan Center by day, and my head really started spinning straight away to, sure I wanted to participate in this collection drive, and I contacted the family straight away and offered to be part of their project. But the next thing sort of that stymied me and kept me from doing anything else but thinking about this was, why wasn't this a systemic agenda? Why wasn't this part of our policymaking? It seemed to me quite remarkably simple to get at, even without studying it too much. I came up with a few quick ways straight away that our laws could be crafted or adjusted to ensure that menstrual products were affordable and accessible to those who needed them. And it didn't seem that hard to do, other than the idea that nobody wanted to talk about it. But in any event, I started sort of piecing this together in my head. And with the platform of this essay came a lot of conversations and a lot of opportunities to start connecting with activists and advocates and legislators, including Representative Meng's office, which was one of the first contacts I had early on. I started just kind of making up some policy ideas and throwing them into the op-eds and seeing if anyone would notice. And imagine my surprise when I got a call from Congresswoman's office saying, "You think this is a good idea? Because we kind of think it's a good idea." And lo and behold, she's turned it into legislation. And that's the flexible spending account piece of it, which Rachel will talk about in a bit. And I guess the other piece to sort of put into the puzzle here is my brain started churning as to what a policy agenda could be. Two other things really started happening. One was that I was starting to frame that policy agenda and think about, well, what would work? What would people respond to or listen to? And while the public health frame and the human rights frame that was so prevalent in the global work resonated. Again, I work for the Brennan Center for Justice by Day, and the idea of this as an equity and participation issue struck me as something that nobody had really done or considered, and that it was really ripe for engagement. If the stories could be told, it seemed to me that the idea that not only are those whose participation is potentially being denied for lack of access to products or health or the services or the education that they need, so too were all of our societal interests being compromised. And so that was deliberate at first, but it's become more deliberate over the course of this agenda, that this was truly, I think, an American and ideal that we might be able to put this kind of oddball invisible issue of menstruation into that context. But I guess the other contextual thing to answer for you is that this wasn't just me who was thinking about it at the time. And I can say that, you know, I became what some might call like obsessed with it. And it really kind of, you know, guided my every thought and interaction. But amazingly, other people were starting to experience the same thing. And over the course of the year, all this, you know, really kind of radical activism emerged. There was a young woman who ran the London Marathon, you know, free bleeding. Basically, Karen Gandhi is her name, and basically she showed up at the start line of the marathon, discovered she had her period, decided the safest way to run was with no products at all, but did so really, you know, as a political statement. It was quite bold about it, and her story went viral. And within a couple of...
When was that?
That was in April 2015.
So I think like that year is important.
2015 kind of became, well, so by New Year's Day 2015, full year from my New Year's Day revelation, NPR declared 2015 the year of the period. And they really did. Like I didn't, that's not fake news. That really happened. But there were other things that happened over the course of the year too. One of the kind of most interesting moments was if you can really let your head go back to August 2015 when there were 17 candidates for the Republican nomination for president, time we can all barely remember. They all stood on the stage on a very hot night in August in Ohio and had the very first Republican debate. And Donald Trump, who got kind of testy by the questions that Megyn Kelly was asking him, declared the next morning that she had blood coming out of her wherever, or something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
I think exactly.
That was
blood coming out of her wherever.
That was it. And that launched this entire, you know, social media backlash, hashtag periods are not an insult. And the year kind of went on this way. There were the conversation was happening sort of in every corner of social media, in the media, politically, you know, by athletes, by artists, by musicians.
By startups too. I mean, we've seen an enormous rise of new companies bringing new products to the market, and that's different from advocacy, but it's a whole other bucket that has helped kind of drive this conversation.
It has, and that's actually been one of the more, I think, interesting aspects of this movement, too. There aren't too many movements where private sector engagement is so relevant because products are actually part of this discussion and part of the solution. But how much we want private sector profit-yielding enterprises to be responsible for a social agenda, for that piece of our lives is something I actually struggle with quite a bit. Overall, I'd say that the emergence of these companies is a good thing, challenging the practices of big business for whom a lot of our laws and policies are crafted. And trust me, it's not to our own personal interest the way a lot of that goes down. Another thing that Congresswoman Meng's office has been so out front and center on is product safety and transparency in what we're allowed to know about our products. You'd be sort of horrified and floored to hear how limited the information you're entitled to know about what's in our tampons and pads. And that's regulated by the FDA. And I'm sure I'm not speaking out of line when I say Procter & Gamble has a whole lot to do with how those laws are crafted. So the idea that there are young startups that are led by women that embed feminist values into their ethos, into their entire work process and into their products is a good thing. And that excites me enormously. Also, the more options we have for managing our menstruation, the better. The integration with social movement, though, is interesting. I do hope that other social movements can actually look to us and what we're doing and how we're figuring out how to mine the line between private sector industry and public sector movement building. You know, I hope that actually turns out to be an incredible case study at the end of this.
So one of my favorite anecdotes from our early conversations was when you said to me, at some point, did you know that tampons have not been exempt from sales tax or deemed a necessity, but in Texas, cowboy boots are. And in California, Pop-Tarts are. And there's this like whole long list. You should Google it if you're not familiar with it.
It's in the book.
Better. You should buy the book and look at it in the book. You decided to introduce the menstrual agenda in the U.S. by focusing on sales tax reform, also called the tampon tax. Why did you think this was the right starting point?
So as this idea kind of started to morph, this view of menstrual equity, the idea of the economics of menstruation being a question of civic engagement and participation, I had a bazillion ideas actually about how policies could be tweaked and addressed and infiltrated to address menstruation. Because quite frankly, none of them do. It's not at the fore of any sort of our policymaking or decision making. It's not at the table. It's not even in the room. So this idea of bringing the economics of menstruation to our policymaking, it felt kind of radical at the time. And when I would talk to people about it, they'd say, you're gonna make an argument for free tampons. And again, back in time, this is when Jeb Bush was the front runner for the Republican nomination and was going around saying that if you vote for Democrats, they'll get, they promise free stuff. That's the Democrat creed. And they said, really, you want to go with free tampons? That seems kind of a questionable place to start. And I thought that the sales tax issue, and I didn't make this up, these were campaigns that were being waged around the world. Canada actually succeeded in 2015, in that summer, the first Western country to eliminate its national sales tax on menstrual products. And that was a campaign that was decades in the making. For what it's worth, and this is something I learned over the past 2 years, Kenya has actually had this policy since 2004. So trust me when I say the Western world is not at the forefront of this. But in any event, it was not prevalent here. It wasn't part of the discussion here. And it seemed kind of the safest, easiest way to take a baby step in. It struck me, most people hear the line you give about cowboy boots or Pop-Tarts, and again, there's 38 other examples in the book, that are equally questionable. When most people hear that, their jaw kind of drops a little bit. And they assume that there is some sexism here. They assume that it's maybe rooted in some archaic laws. Who really understands tax law? But they get that it's unfair. The other thing is it didn't require that leap of compassion or willingness to look at lives through the lens of what it means to lack agency or be marginalized or just be poor. This affects all of us. A lot of people who are right-leaning don't like tax as much either. I know we're not supposed to be partisan, but one of my best one-liners that's emerged here is that a lot of the Republicans needed to decide which they hated more, taxes or women. And turns out it's taxes. So, no, it's not. Anyway, this seemed kind of like the place that could get some simple traction and would be the easiest way to get legislators to start saying words like tampons and menstruation, and to get the public on board. I put up this petition in the fall of 2015, and I had the good fortune of hooking up with Cosmopolitan Magazine, which co-sponsored it. So, you know, it enabled us to sort of have a broad readership for it. And, you know, one of the goals in doing so was to actually elevate the national discourse on this. Here at home, taking on the tampon tax, as we like to call it. It's got alliteration too, and I tend to think good campaigns have alliteration and good hashtags, so hashtag tampon tax stuck also. When we put this up in the fall, with the hopes of springing this campaign, you know, for the next legislative session in 2016, the goal was really to elevate a national discourse around this too. So having a national partner like that really mattered. This was going to be a state by state fight here, unlike in many other countries where it's a national tax, or in Europe where it's connected to the EU's value added tax. And I'm not going to talk about that tonight, but please read that section of the book. It's one of the most fascinating stories, how Brexit hijacked the tampon tax in the UK. And it's really kind of disturbing, but, fascinating nonetheless. Here, though, we knew we were going to have to go state by state. It was going to be hard to have any sort of state campaign if there wasn't, it seemed to me, national level pressure. It wasn't just that a California legislator might do it, or a Nebraska legislator might do it, or a Florida legislator might do it. Everybody had to feel that pressure. So having that kind of platform for it was really exciting. It's gotten a lot of signatures. It's picked up about 100,000 signatures. But one of the really interesting things about it was that I had access to send emails to everybody who signed the petition. So I I do so every so often, and I started testing actually how people who felt strongly about the tampon tax felt about access issues. So I would sneak it in sometimes, and the response was sometimes, it was overwhelming. People would say, yo, I signed this about the tampon tax. I don't want to give free stuff to people. So it really actually helped me to think about what the talking points could be as we could morph. The tampon tax was never intended to be the last stop. It was always the first stop. And I should say that in terms of just legislative progress, we started 2016 with 40 of the 50 states not exempting menstrual products from sales tax. Five states just had no sales tax at all, so they didn't tax them. And five, they just fell into some sort of category that caused them to be tax exempt. But 40 still had the tax. Since then, 24 states have introduced legislation to eliminate this tax, and four have gotten it done. Of the four that have gotten it done, two have been signed by Republican governors in Florida and in Illinois. New York is the third state, although it was the first state to do it. And then Connecticut is the fourth, and the Connecticut story I just have to tell because it's really cool too. They'd introduced legislation, it failed, and it was a young freshman legislator who had introduced the bill. And as karma would have it, she was the last vote on the budget that year, June, and she held the budget hostage until they put a line in to at least cover the exemption for the next 2 years of the life of the budget. So anyway, but as you're asking, yes, it was a first step. It was intended to get us to these broader questions of equity and access and participation.
And you hinted at this just now, but the tampon tax has gotten bipartisan support. And at a time when the battle over women's bodies is so notoriously divided by a really hard, clear line, how can that be? Like, how do you make sense of that?
So sometimes I actually have to struggle to make sense of it a little bit too, because it is strange and unique and fascinating that this issue of menstruation, which had been invisible on a good day, marginalized and mocked on a bad, became the thing that was that is the safe place for bipartisan engagement. One of the more interesting things that happened this past summer, now we're zigzagging out of order, so we'll circle back. But the Bureau of Prisons, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is part of the U.S. Department of Justice, issued a guidance, which is a rule that's written, kind of unenforceable, but still written, mandating that federal inmates be afforded free access to menstrual products. And this is Jeff Sessions' Department of Justice that did this. That is really quite radical. I was contacted, there was an article about it in the Huffington Post, and because there was legislation that was introduced in the U.S. Senate that had a similar component, and it was this kind of broad-reaching criminal justice legislation called the Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act, and it includes some really much needed reforms that impact the lives of women who are incarcerated. Everything from being forced to be shackled during labor and delivery and other medical appointments to access to visitation with their children, and access to menstrual products was one of the provisions. And that was the headline of the first article that came out. And I contacted the reporter because I was kind of curious. I said, why did you lead with that? Just out of curiosity, because there's so much to this bill. I mean, this is great. I'm thrilled. But she said, well, this is the no-brainer. This is the thing that everybody agrees on. This is the easy thing. And I thought, I had to like put the phone down for a second. I thought, wow, that would be true. That's what's happened. But the answer to the question of why, I guess goes to the very essence of this bodily function, which is, it just is. It's not red or blue. It's not Democrat or Republican. It's just part of our lives. And you're right. In this, in this environment now where women's bodies and women's experiences are so undermined, and we're so aware of that through especially all of the discussions over the past few weeks and hashtag Me Too and the awareness of sexual assault in the workplace and on the streets, and people being surprised when women say, no, this is daily life. This isn't something exceptional. This is just what we cope with. Well, so is menstruation. So this is absolutely part of this agenda and what feels like this kind of ignited reality we're in right now. Maybe we have no choice. We're fighting for our lives in this political environment. But this agenda and this issue, the fact that we've made that happen, I'm less concerned actually right now about why this is the thing that's stuck, and more focused on how to ensure that this is the thing that propels us forward. I'll just say one other thing, that when I was writing this book, especially over the past year, I was kind of in the heart of writing in November, December, January, and it was a really depressing time to be writing. For all the obvious reasons. But the thing that was depressing me was like, who's going to care about this issue? Who's going to read this book? Does this matter? This is so tiny. Tampon tax, 8 cents on the dollar. We're fighting for our lives right now. And I would despair, like all the momentum we'd built up in the year of the period, maybe it just was going to get swallowed. But the exact opposite has happened. This is the very, if we can't do this, then I don't know where we're at. This is where we have to start. This is the root of all of it. This is the most natural state of our bodies. And again, now it is the place that has bipartisan support. It is the place where we're winning. We're not just towing the line. We're not just stopping the worst things from happening, but we're actually getting stuff done. We're succeeding. We're achieving. We're putting forward a new narrative. We're telling a new story in our voices. So yeah, sorry. I always get a little distracted.
So let's pause there for a second on policy and turn it over to Rachna Shah, who is Senior Policy Advisor for Congresswoman Meng. Now, Congresswoman Meng has led the charge on the issue of access and affordability and safety of menstrual products. And she's done that by being both bold and creative. She's introduced bills. She's appealed to the Department of Justice and state governors. She's even influenced the Department of Homeland Security. So talk to us a little bit about this work, where it comes from, and also for you personally, like what draws you to this work?
Hello? Hello? Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Rachna. I'm Senior Policy Advisor for Congresswoman Grace Meng. And I'm going to try to give you guys a short synopsis of the backstory about how we started to create a menstrual equity legislative agenda. And it starts back in 2015, so it'll mirror some of Jennifer's story, and with a high school student who wrote to the congresswoman and said, you know, I learned about my peers who don't have access to tampons and don't have access to these products, and they're skipping school because of it. And I never thought that this would happen here in Queens. And it was right around the time that Jennifer had published her second op-ed. And, you know, we'd read this letter from the student, and as Jennifer keeps referring to, it just resonates. It resonated with us. It resonated with the congresswoman. You know, when we started thinking about it, and the congresswoman said, well, let's do something. What can we do? And then I want to put it a little bit, so it's just that immediate, when you hear the stories, it actually makes a difference. And if you ever think that you, writing into your legislator, doesn't make a difference, that's how this started. So a little bit of hope, guys. So we started looking into this, and then to put in context, we have to function within what the congresswoman can do at the federal level and deal with these issues federally. And of course, use the power of her office and her voice to advocate on all these issues, but
legislatively focus on what we can do federally. So we took the easiest thing that we could tackle of all these, you know, kind of issues and looked at the flexible spending account and said, well, we can write a really quick piece of legislation that says you should be able to use your flexible spending account to purchase these products. Right now, that's not the case.
Can I jump in for one second?
Absolutely.
Because this is actually really fascinating, especially fascinating if you're like a wonky person who likes like parsing through laws and all the technicalities of it. So the reason you can't use your flexible spending account dollars for menstrual products is because the IRS has chosen not to classify them as medical products. The IRS goes so far as to point out other federal agencies that do. The FDA, for example, even though the FDA does so in a very weak way, and says, but we're tax experts, and we think we understand medical products better. And I kid you not, that's pretty much exactly what it says. You can read it in, you can read, I cut it off of their website in the book. This is ludicrous, and so fixable. So fixable. Absolutely. So back at you.
Sure. Absolutely. So we introduced this bill and we took it from there and then we started looking at it. And one of the things that we were struck by the more the Congresswoman and I, you know, to give you context, I handle women's issues and justice issues for the Congresswoman. And it's why I was primarily starting to work on these issues with her. And the more we started to read and learn and where the news is important, why reporters who are, people who are writing talk about these issues and share these stories, we're reading them and taking it in. And so we started looking at all these issues and then again, what we could do federally. Again, to put in context, this was 2015. We had, for our office, a friendly administration and a not so friendly leadership, an opposition leadership in Congress. So we were looking towards the administration and trying to work directly there and see what changes we could make. And one of the first things we looked at was this FEMA grant run through the Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Emergency Food and Shelter National Board Program. It's a special grant. It's a really odd name. So we started looking. This is a grant where homeless assistance providers can use to purchase mass shelter items. And so then it made complete sense. It wasn't on the list, and so we reached out to FEMA and said, well, you know, why isn't on the list? Is on the list?
What kind of things are on the list?
Yeah, it was soap and pillows and blankets and toothbrushes, and it just made sense. And they said, you know, we're open to it. They actually, FEMA responded and said, no one's ever asked us that before. And so the Congresswoman made a formal request.
And it's done.
And they agreed. And that was it. And that really kicked off a lot of our momentum. From there, we actually wrote to Attorney General Lynch about the federal Bureau of Prisons issue and having federally incarcerated women get access to these products. And we were focused, you know, and we started dealing with it. The way that we've talked about it is, different populations of women and girls face different issues of access. And so we've tried to sort of handle this discreetly and try to identify really small problems that we can tackle and make change in these really incremental ways because that's how we're going to get something done. And that's what we did for homeless women. That's how we've sort of tried to deal with it with incarcerated women, with women in the workplace and requiring large employers to provide these free of charge to their employees. Not the mom and pop shops, but the really large, you know, 100 employee or more companies. And for low-income women in trying to create this tax credit. And then, of course, dealing with the safety issues, which affects all women. And so we started putting together pieces of legislation that deal with each of these. And then fast forward to 2017, we no longer had a friendly administration, and so we put them all together, and we created this large package bill called the Menstrual Equity for All Act, which every section is a different piece of our proposals, and we also introduced the Menstrual Products Right to Know Act, which deals with the disclosure of ingredients and the safety issues. That's what we're working on now, and that's where we're moving forward from here.
Thank you. I've been thinking about how unusual it is to get to track the growth of a movement like this over such a short period of time in a moment where it's so easy to track something like this because of social media and the internet and everything like that. And I want to talk for a second about media and the role that journalists, articles, news coverage, social media, hashtag campaigns have played in kind of helping to not only inspire you and your work, but really put a spotlight on this issue at the national level. But I'll first just hold on a second and I'll just say that this is the Brennan Center for Justice Program at NYU Law School, and we are talking to Jennifer Weiss-Wolf about mental equity. I am Abigail Jones, your moderator. You can follow the Brennan Center for Justice on Facebook and Twitter, watch our programs on YouTube, and listen to our iTunes podcasts. All our reports and media are on our website at brennancenter.org. So I think that's for the listeners who are not here in person. But anyway, to this issue of media, talk about the role that this has played over the last 2 years.
One of the things I've actually said when people ask me about that is that the media is like a character in this story, actually. There's been, one of the ways that we talk about achieving legal and social change at the Brennan Center for Justice is by influencing the public discourse and influencing public opinion. So I came to the advocacy with that in mind and an understanding that working with the media and helping to elevate any agenda was going to be an important strategy. For an issue like this, though, where there'd been no public attention or storytelling, and where I knew that the storytelling would affect people's engagement, it just seemed a necessity to have that kind of attention. Again, for a lot of reasons, not just because the stories haven't been told, but I also knew if we wanted legislators to act, they would have to understand that the public wanted them to act, and they would have to hear these stories themselves, and they would have to know that their constituents wanted them to do this, and that their constituents would have their backs if they kind of went out there. I mean, I think that's, you agree with that? It's true, yeah. And that's how, anyway, that was where I started. And the media has been, I don't even know if there's a superlative enough word to describe how important the media strategy has been for this. Because it's not just been quantity, and I promise you, if you Google the words menstrual equity or you Google the words tampon tax, there has been so much coverage. I really need to get a database so I can count it and know. I'm sure it's in the way, 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 way high thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. I don't know. It's a ton. And the media, it's not just been the quantity, though. It's been the quality. And I mean, working with Newsweek, I have to say, actually, working with Newsweek was one of my very early visions for this. I knew I wanted to work with a major women's magazine, and I knew I wanted to work with a mainstream news reporting source. They have different audiences. They have different perspectives. And I knew both would be highly influential in telling this story and laying forth this agenda. Honestly, I dreamed and envisioned a cover story too. So I when Abigail called me the day to start this interview, I started right away. I'm like, you think this could be a feature story? You know, maybe this could be a cover story. I don't know. What do you think? And we kind of, you know, we got ourselves there pretty quickly. But the media has been so responsible in reporting on this and so deft at doing the storytelling. But I have to say, I've also committed myself to spending a lot of time to working with the media and helping to frame and helping to do research and helping to ensure that the reporting was as high quality as I wanted it to be. And it's kind of now, and as we look back at it, it's not just been the cover of Newsweek and Cosmopolitan, but it's been everything from New York Times editorials to The Economist to feminist millennial blogs. I know them all now. Like everybody's 50-year-old favorite, you know, like I get it. I know how to work with them. And but even the conservative places, when Breitbart first started covering this, you can imagine what the tenor of the discourse was. They'd actually pulled a picture off my Instagram. I'm really grateful it was a good picture. Because they used it and went around a lot. I was wearing really good boots in it, which was really fortunate. But more recently, they've decided, the right wing has decided that the tampon tax really is kind of sexist and bad. And when Congresswoman Meng's office put out the Menstrual Equity for All Act, they kind of had a field day making fun of it, because that's what they do. But the way they made fun of it, they said, well, we don't like free stuff, but this tampon tax thing is bad news. It's sexist. It's unfair. And I actually pulled out all their quotes and pieced them together into my, I still haven't published it, but I'm dying to publish this piece. And it looks like I wrote it. And at the end, it says, actually, Maya Leonopoulos wrote this. Like, these are not my words. These are their words. So the media has been extraordinarily, extraordinarily important in this. And I think that goes to the Brennan Center lesson and model that elevating public opinion and bringing the public along with the narrative that you want to craft is a really, really relevant advocacy strategy. I think we're supposed to be moving on to questions soon.
I just wanted to add one thing, because so when I first started working on the cover story, there were articles out there, most of them focused on one moment. So the viral video of Barack Obama saying that probably tampons are taxed because men made those laws, the London Marathon, the Instagram photo that went viral about the period blood coming through a woman's clothing. But there wasn't a lot that really dissected the bigger issue. Fast forward a year and a half, internally at Newsweek, whenever I pitch a period-related story, and I get these pitches like multiple times a week, for everything. The editors are so aware and they really get it that I get pushback. They're kind of like, well, why? Why does that story matter? Why does this new company matter? It's almost refreshing that it's really such an accepted line of inquiry, an accepted beat to have. And that's really how far it's come in a year and a half. But I want to just pause and open it up for questions now from the audience. We would love to hear from you and have Jen answer and Rachna as well. So please come up to the microphone if you have a question and introduce yourself and share your brief one-part question.
Not that that was heavy-handed already.
Thank you.
I'm David Linton. Is this on? Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
I'm a member of the board of the Society for Menstrual Cycle Research, and I've had the great honor and privilege of working with Jen on some of our issues. And I have sort of two questions or issues that I would appreciate your commenting on. In a way, this discussion has been framed as though this was a new phenomenon, as though it's only been 2 years that suddenly we're in this menstrual moment, as the year of the period seems to suggest. However, the Society for Menstrual Cycle Research, as you know, just celebrated its 40th year of work on menstrual liberation, if you will, and menstrual education, which corresponds with the same year of Gloria Steinem's essay, If Men Could Menstruate. So activism has been activated quite a long time. So my first question has to do with, why did this last couple of years constitute what we might call a tipping point or a paradigm shift, that we have decades of effort to liberate, to bring menstruation out of the closet? What was it about the late moment that brought this about, as people like Gladwell talk about the tipping point, or people who talk about a paradigm shift suggest that it takes a long time, but then something has to happen for it to move over. So I'd like your comment on that. Secondly, the issue of political action I'm fascinated by. We had in the Society for Menstrual Cycle Research this slogan, detax and detox the tampon, which is part of what you're talking about that we have been promoting. And the idea was to be able to speak to your conservative Republican legislators and say, finally, this is your chance to do something nice for the vagina. Now, is the problem here that they will latch on to this feel-good issue and support detoxification, if I may, but is that a token, or is it a sign of significant change? Is it good for feminism, or is it just a pat on the head?
Can I answer the second one first, actually? Because I do think there's a concern about that, and I think that's a valid concern, and I hear it frequently that, especially when I'm dealing with advocates who are working, you know, on the front lines in the states, who some of the people who are their worst enemies or, you know, the ones that they're kind of on the battle lines with all the time, and they were like, don't give them credibility on this. This is really dangerous. They're barely scratching the surface, and they're doing damage every other day of the week. And so I'm really mindful of that, and I think that we have to be strategic about understanding where we can get wins, especially in an environment like this right now, and take those. I want those policy wins right now. And I also want to be mindful of what some of the trade-offs or at least contextual background is for these legislators. So I think we could do both at the same time. I'm not going to, me personally as an advocate, I am not going to loud them and put them up on a pedestal for taking one small step into what is otherwise, you know, a giant expanse of work they could and should be doing on behalf of women's bodies, whether it's menstrual equity or much broader. But on the other hand, if we're actually finding some common ground and some traction on their behalf right now, I think we'd be foolish to put it off or say it has to be all or nothing, or I refuse to give you any credibility at all. Because that's why we're in these polarized, that's part of why we're in these polarized corners where we are. And both sides are part of that. And so I am willing to actually have that level of pragmatism, at least in my own activism. And I know maybe all others wouldn't agree with me, but that's been my mindset. And I think that's why, that's part of why we've seen so much legislative progress on this particular issue, at least the tax issue for sure. I mean, the detox issue is a whole nother one, but that's been, you know, the first bill the folks know that was the first federal bill, in this kind of post-toxic shock syndrome era and revelations about what the FDA knows and doesn't know about the ingredients in testing of menstrual products was introduced in 1997 by Representative Carolyn Maloney here in New York. It's been introduced 10 times in the House and has gone nowhere. That's really challenging and really frustrating. If it took doing something a little bit differently and jolting people, I think that's a sign of progress. And that kind of, I guess, leads to the second question, because I love working with David and lots of folks at the Society of Menstrual Cycle Research and being part of your network. And by no means do I think that this issue is brand new. It's brand new for me as of 2015. I'm clear about when I stumbled into it. All the work you'd been doing for the years prior, sadly, hadn't been part of my life, and I wish it had, because my life's been so great since January 1st, 2015, and I'm beyond thrilled to be part of this movement. And I've learned so much from everyone, from Gloria Steinem, straight on through the folks at Society of Menstrual Cycle Research, and bring that knowledge and wisdom and perspective to this book, to my advocacy. But honestly, if some legislators or blogs want to think that it's new and brand new, I think that's fine too, because it's bringing all this momentum that just didn't exist on the most mainstream level before. And I think that it's, as we all go forward together, kind of bringing your years of experience and wisdom to some of these new forms of organizing and even new ways of conceptualizing this is where our power is going to lie. I hope that answers your question.
Let me just add one more thing very, very quickly. I just, because you mentioned Gloria Steinem's essay in Ms. Magazine. I just really quickly want to read a couple sentences for those of you who have never read this because it's phenomenal. It was published in 1978. She wrote, "What would happen, for instance, if suddenly, magically, men could menstruate and women could not? The answer is clear. Menstruation would be an enviable, boastworthy, masculine event. Men would brag about how long and how much." And unquote. And now I'm just reading from my article, so I'm summarizing. Steinem envisioned a world where, quote unquote, menstruation justifies men's place pretty much everywhere, in combat, political office, religious leadership positions, and medical schools. We'd have, quote unquote, Paul Newman tampons and, quote unquote, Muhammad Ali's rope-a-dope pads and a new model for compliments. Man, you looking good. Yeah, I'm on the rag. Just had to share that. It's so wonderful. Okay.
Hi, I'm Nikki. I'm an MSW candidate at NYU. And it's interesting that you read that because my question was actually going to be, nowadays, women aren't the only ones having periods. You know, there are trans men who menstruate as well. So I'm curious, and, you know, after hearing you speak, I'll be honest, I haven't read your book yet, but I'm very interested in reading your book. So I'm interested in, is there worry about the rhetoric of policy, like, for instance, for this FSA account, flexible spending account, is the rhetoric going to be that women, quote unquote, women are the only ones going to be allowed to use their flexible spending accounts? Or do you have any worry about the rhetoric regarding policy and menstruation?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I sort of have a two-part answer to it too. This is a theme of the book, and there's a whole section of the book called Policies That Transcend Gender. And, you know, just even in my own life through my own family and kids and their friends, I've had more and more exposure to this personally. So it kind of takes on a more personal, angle as I've tried to explore it. And some small things that I've done, at least in my own processing of this and really trying to understand and appreciate the pain of exclusion from broad sweeping language about that people who menstruate are women and girls. I've tried to shift my own language. I think language is a very powerful tool, and I've tried to shift my own language as much as I can. I will say menstrual products. I won't use the word feminine. I won't use the word hygiene either, actually. I try to say as much as I can to people who menstruate and be inclusive in the conversation. But quite honestly, I can't always. Because it is also true that a lot of the biases around menstruation are rooted in ages-old misogyny, and that misogyny actually drives so many of the patriarchal norms that harm us all. So I see that as one and the same to some extent. But I also do find in policymaking, you're right, there are risks amongst policymakers who won't use the language or don't want to use the language or feel they're going to alienate other of their constituents if they do. And it's a little bit of a dance. It's a little bit of a, again, pragmatic decision about how much to win and how much to force. A lot of, here in New York, we had the hearings about, for the bills around, menstrual products in the schools, correction facilities, and shelters. The bill was originally written with the words feminine hygiene products, and almost every single, including Planned Parenthood of New York City, almost every single body that testified asked them to change it and said that it was not inclusive and said that it was problematic. So we're making strides. If ultimately it becomes the difference of winning and losing a legislative fight, I got to tell you, I want to win the legislative fight and educate as I go. But it hasn't actually been that cut and dry all along. Before the book was released, I actually did an interview with Human Rights Campaign on the issue, and it was very clear in doing the interview that I don't speak for the trans community. I know who I am, and I know who I'm not. But I try to infuse it as much of that inclusion in my activism and advocacy and even in my writing as I think is possible. And I also, and I'll be curious for once folks read it, their responses to this section called, that's called Policies That Transcend Gender. Instead of me deciding what trans menstrual issues should be, I sort of do the reverse and say, well, how can menstrual activists be better allies and supporters of a trans agenda where the two issues overlap? Everything from healthcare access to bathroom bills. And that's the frame in which I look at it. I'll be curious for people's feedback.
Let's have, the flexible.
Yes, piece. Sure.
Sorry, I just wanted to address your question really quickly. I lost where you went. As someone who helps draft legislation around this issue, it's something that we do deal with and think about a lot. And if you, at least the way that we've handled it, is to write the legislation itself to be inclusive, it refers to people who menstruate, or it's not limited to men and women, but it is a constant conversation about how are we communicating these issues. So sometimes we talk about women and girls because it's something that people just understand more, and we try to have as much as possible an active conversation with the activist community just so they know that we understand and we're on the same page. But we struggle with the same thing that Jen has, and it's not meant to be exclusive or not thought about, but just sometimes being pragmatic and not, or pragmatic and trying to deal with the communication aspect of it.
Thank you. So we have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm Emily, and I have interned at the Brennan Center for about a year, and I am also the president of Students for Sexual Respect at NYU, and we recently won a campaign to get free menstrual hygiene products at NYU, so this is sort of a two worlds collide. Thank you. And my fellow advocates are over there. So I wanted to sort of ask if you could talk about a little bit about the sort of future of this movement. Because one thing that we've found is that, you know, we have the administration has allocated funds for a certain number of bathrooms at NYU. And we've done calculations that say about women and people who menstruate are spending about $10 per month on menstrual products, and including Advil, which is necessary. We were sort of thinking, you know, it's like $120 a year. That's a concert. You don't, like, anyone can appreciate $120. And sort of how can we create a paradigm shift in terms of, you know, how people can think about this as a cost that isn't something that's something like toilet paper, that it doesn't necessarily just apply to people that literally cannot afford the products, but that anyone shouldn't have to pay for this because it's a cost that is discriminatory.
That's a perfect last question, actually. And a paradigm shift, I think, is exactly what I'm envisioning when I think about the future of this advocacy and of this movement. So at least for the legislative successes of the past couple of years, they've focused primarily on economic and access issues, and they've taken them sort of head on. And there's a lot more to do there. If we want to see all 50 states exempt menstrual products from sales tax, we have 36 to go. If we want to see more states and municipalities introduce legislation like New York City's that make menstrual products freely accessible for those who need them, we have a very long way to go. Although I'll share the latest two updates. There have been several, actually, since I was pencils down on the book, but the latest two are just in the past couple of weeks. The state of California passed a law that Governor Brown signed that makes menstrual products freely available in all of the state's public schools. That's a lot. And same with the state of Illinois, signed by Governor Rauner, a Republican. And so there's loads of work to do just to advance that agenda alone. Factor in the safety agenda and addressing the safety and transparency issues. And those are just the things we've already started to carve out and define very clearly. But what I do in this book, which is maybe the most exciting part of it, is I take the whole third section of the book, comes up with this new vision for looking at our laws that kind of flips this menstrual piece on its head almost. And rather than looking at where can we make menstrual products affordable or safer, it does the reverse. It says, let's look at our laws and consider the fact that half of the people who live by these laws have bodies that do this. In some cases, it's way more than half, because a lot of the laws and rules and policies we have that are directed at people who are low income or otherwise marginalized, women are disproportionately represented in those populations. And let's look at those laws through that lens. So let's say we understand that half the people who are going to live by this law, their body's going to do this. Does this law accurately, adequately reflect that reality? And could it do a little better? So I took 9 areas of public policy and public life. I always try to list them, and I always leave off one. So I leave off a different one every time. You can look in the back and see what they are. But I've taken 9, and they range from nutritional benefits to health care to education to gender equity issues to reproductive rights to the environment to philanthropy to homelessness to corrections. I think I just named them all. And I look at them through that lens and say, why are these laws set up the way they are? And would they do better by menstruating bodies if they acknowledged as such? And I propose what a lot of these tweaks could be. And sort of just like the way I proposed it in this one particular essay about the flexible spending account allowances, I do the same. And I'm no expert in benefits law or employment law or labor law or health law, but I did my best to really kind of parse out these laws and why they stand the way they are now, and would they look different if we did this? And my answer is yes. And I put it out there as an invitation to all of you to be activists and spokespeople and advocates on behalf of these ideas, and to people like Rachna who are making these laws get drafted and working for incredible leaders in Congress and in state houses and in our municipal governments across the country to put them into action. So the third part of the book is really that very blueprint of what I see the future of this being. So read away. I think that's it.
Jen, thank you so much for this extraordinary evening and sharing all of your thoughts with us, and Rachna, for you too. Thank you to the Brennan Center for Justice and our co-sponsors and all of you who are here and everybody listening online. I'll just add, Jen, you are an absolute force. You are, it is extraordinary what you have done. When I think about how this movement has shifted over the last year and a half or 2 years since your discovery on New Year's, you touch every moment of that. And I can't wait. I think we all can't wait to see what you do next and where you take this important work. So thank you.
Thank you.